Majority Report with Sam Cedar.
It is Monday, December 25th. It's Christmas Day. Oh, we have a wonderful package for you to open up. My name is Sam Cedar. This is the five-time award-winning Majority Report. We are broadcasting live. Can you believe it? We're live. We're live on Christmas Day. No, we're not. We're live to tape. We have a Christmas special for you. I mean, it's not very Christmassy, as I actually, now that I think about it, I mean, it just, we just realized as we were recording this, hey, wait a second, that's on Christmas Day. Is somebody really going to listen to a podcast on Christmas Day? And then I was like, well, I mean, the worst case scenario would be that someone wants to listen to a podcast on Christmas Day and it's not there.
It'd be like a lump of coal.
It would be like a lump of coal. Actually, no, a lump of coal, at least someone's taken the time to put something in the sock, in your stocking. It would be like an empty stocking. That's what it would be like. And say a lot of things about me, folks. Nobody's calling me an empty stocking lever. No one has ever called me that, and no one ever will call me that. So for you today on the program, we have a best of 2017. It is from April 14th, 2017, the most appropriate year for the Best of 17 series. And it's Ganesh Sitaraman. He's an assistant professor of law at Vanderbilt Law School, talking about his book, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. So sit back, listen to this. If you didn't hear it the first time, you should listen. If you heard it the first time, you should listen again. That's why we call it the best of 2017. And then are we going to put any other like YouTube stuff? What are we going to do,
baby? Yeah, it's going to be a YouTube best of all week this week.
OMG, as my daughter would say. Well, maybe we'll do that Tuesday through Thursday or Friday. I don't know if we need it today. I mean, it is Christmas.
Okay, yeah, just Ganesh then today.
We're going to let the elves off, and there'll be more tomorrow. So sit back, enjoy this. We will be back live in 2018, ladies and gentlemen. I hope you had a Merry Christmas, if that's your thing, or I hope you're having one, if that's your thing. If you don't, if that's not your thing, if you're like me, and you're just sitting, like, you're just drinking, watching it all, happen in front of you, the kids coming over, and then I hope you had a happy time doing that too. All right. Enjoy this. We'll see you tomorrow. We got great shows all this week. We are back, Sam Cedar, on the Majority Report on the phone. It is a pleasure to welcome to the program Ganesh Sitaraman. He is the Associate Professor of Law at Vanderbilt Law School and a Senior Fellow at the Center for American Progress. He is also the author of his most recent, The Crisis of the Middle Class Constitution, Why Economic Inequality Threatens Our Republic. Welcome to the program, Ganesh.
Thanks so much. It's great to be here.
So let's, I want to start with this notion that, I guess let me quote you to you. You write that the danger of income inequality is far outweighs the risks of a rise of presidential power, of like a growing national security state, and that private economic power has been more central to American history than the fear of government power. Extrapolate on that, please.
So the core claim of the book is that the real crisis that we face today in our constitutional system is one that's fundamentally about an imbalance in economic power, rising economic inequality, and the collapse of the middle class. And the reason why this is so important is that what the founders believed and what people throughout American history believed is that it wasn't possible to have a republic, to have our constitutional system, without having relative economic equality. And I know that may sound a little surprising, but it makes sense when you think about the history of governments. And I'll take you back pretty far to think about this. But for most of Western history, people were very concerned about economic inequality. They thought that the rich would either oppress the poor or the poor would try to confiscate the wealth of the rich. And the result would be strife, instability, violence, and revolution. And the way out of this problem was to build economic class right into the structure of government. So in England, you've got a House of Lords for the wealthy, a House of Commons for everybody else. In ancient Rome, there's a patrician senate for the wealthy. There's a tribune of the plebs for the poor, for everybody else. And each of these classes, because they have a share in government, also have a check on the other, and that's what creates stability. Now, what's surprising is our Constitution doesn't have any of that. You know, we don't have a tribune of the plebs. We don't have property requirements to be a member of the Senate. And the reason why we don't have that is our founders built our Constitution on the assumption that we actually didn't have the kind of divides between rich and poor, the level of economic inequality that afflicted all these previous societies, and therefore we didn't need that. And so the problem today is when we have this economic inequality, it really cuts at the heart of our Constitution, which wasn't designed for these kind of conditions.
In fact, you refer to it as a middle-class Constitution as opposed to the class warfare Constitution that at least sets up, I guess, a government. I mean, there's not necessarily a constitution in the UK, but that concept of organizing the government in that way. We should just say, just tell folks, because I know you contemplate the idea of reintroducing a tribune of plebs. Tell us what that was.
So in ancient Rome, there was a position called the tribune of the plebs, and there were multiple tribunes, about 10 of them. They were selected only from the plebeians, so outside of the elite patrician class. And they were selected only from that group, and they served as the representatives of that group in the government, and they could veto actions of the patrician Senate. They could grant clemency to people who were convicted of crimes. And so they had this considerable power in ancient Rome. And the idea of this power and its emergence was as a check against the wealthy who were being oppressive to everyone else in the early Republic of Rome. You know, there's a proposal today that I discuss in the book that a professor at the University of Chicago has suggested we should reintroduce the Tribune of the Plebs today as a way to deal with our economic inequality and to have this kind of countervailing force to balance the wealthy. And the idea there would be, you know, you have 51, citizens selected by lottery from the general population, except for the top 10%, the wealthiest people would be excluded. And they would be able to veto legislation, veto a executive order, veto a Supreme Court decision every year, and they would serve for a year and get benefits and so on. And the idea is this would be a check against what has come to be in our system the real dominance of the wealthy and powerful.
All right. So, and you know, putting aside the, I guess, the possibility of something like that happening, there's a lot of things that. You know, at least in the last 6 months, have happened that I would have never predicted a year ago. So
that said, I'm not sure you should put money on the Tribune of the Plebs being introduced in the next 6 months. I think this would be unlikely.
That would be highly unlikely. Although I have a feeling some very strange things are going to happen over the next 6 months. But be that as it may, so the construct of our Constitution. I mean. How radical was it relative to what was going on, A, and B, was it simply because there was very few opportunities to have such a clean slate? Like, how radical was the Constitution in those terms, and what were the factors that allowed for it to be so radical?
Yeah, so I think the Constitution was quite radical. You know, a lot of people who are historians of this period or just casual commentators on it think of the Constitution as a very conservative document, almost an aristocratic counter-revolution against the democratic tendencies of the revolution in 1776. But I don't think that's right. And the big divide between the federal Constitution and the constitutions of many of the states, which were created just in the years before, and the governments of almost all of Western history before that, is that they didn't have what I call these class warfare kind of features. They didn't build economic class right into the structure of government. And so, like I said, we don't have a Tribune of the Plebs. We don't have property requirements for senators. That was very, very common. This was debated. It was debated in state legislatures for creating state constitutions. It was debated in the constitutional convention debates for the federal constitution. But it's not in our constitution, and that's a radical shift in the history of governments away from these class warfare structures to what I've called the middle class constitutional structure. And I think what enabled this big shift is a set of conditions that existed here in America that were pretty unique in the history of the world and that the founders recognized as unique in the history of the world. And that was our general sense of equality, economic equality here. And, you know, to take you back to the late 18th century, you know, America at the time is a pretty sparsely populated set of settlements just along the Atlantic seaboard. You know, there are some towns or cities, Boston, New York, but this is nothing like the real center of the world in the late 18th century for these people, which is London and Paris. And Western Europe looks very different to them when they look across the Atlantic. In Western Europe, there's feudalism. There isn't feudalism in America. In Western Europe, there is a hereditary aristocracy. There's not a hereditary aristocracy in America. The richest people in America, people like George Washington, who have, you know, plantations and beautiful houses like Mount Vernon, are pretty wealthy. But this is nothing compared to the dukes and duchesses in England who have gigantic marble palaces. The degree of wealth inequality is just significantly less in America. And on top of all of that, there are these vast lands available to the West that mean that any white man, it was limited to white men at the time, could move west, get a parcel of property to themselves. And most wealth at the time was property. This is before the Industrial Revolution. And be an independent farmer, and as a result, join into the middle class. And so those were the conditions that they operated under, and they recognized that those were special conditions, and that that made them unique as compared to the countries of Western Europe or even the ancients and others that came before them.
So the Constitution is reliant on a middle class. Do we see that structurally in the document, at least, you know, I mean, at that time, simply by its lack or its inhibiting the development of an aristocracy, or are there other factors that we see structurally that we see that make it reliant on this middle class?
So the most important features are that it actually has this absence of these other structures that were designed to deal with economic inequality. That's probably the most important thing, and that's the radical shift that I described before. There are, you know, there's a provision in the Constitution about no titles of nobility, which we can read to be a protection against the creation of an aristocracy in America. So that's a kind of provision built into the Constitution that works that way. But for the most part, the economic conditions were an assumption and a prerequisite that the founders saw to this kind of a system. And so there aren't explicit statements. The word middle class is never used in the Constitution. Economic equality or inequality is not used in the Constitution explicitly. Instead, the founders trusted to these conditions that existed, and they facilitated those conditions through other kinds of policies. So the Northwest Ordinance opened up a chunk of the West. At the time, West was Ohio. And over time, the country continued to move west. That was policy that they undertook. Jefferson talks quite a bit about changing the laws in Virginia to prevent the descent of property from one male to the oldest son and onward, because this is the kind of thing that ties up a lot of wealth in one family or in one individual and creates a kind of pseudo-aristocracy, is what he calls it. And so there are policies that they're trying to undertake to preserve this level of equality in America. But they see that as a policymaking process, something that you do through politics to continue preserving the middle class foundations of the republic.
So Jefferson was a proponent of the death tax.
He had a variety of things that he was a proponent of. Yeah. Related to making sure that estates, as he would call it, would descend to multiple people instead of just one and be broken up over time.
Right. Okay. So I was just imagining Frank Luntz in that period, but
right.
So how much did they did the framers at that time, and how much thought was given at that time to the potential of an agrarian society that will at one point have a finite amount of resources, right? Did they foresee potential problems that might be involved with hitting an ocean on the other side and running out of land and perhaps even industrialization?
So what's surprising is that they did. And there were some debates about this among the founding generation. John Adams, for example, thought that the problem of economic inequality was inevitable and would emerge pretty quickly. And so he actually advocated for these older regimes, the kind of class warfare regimes, and was thought to be just outside the American mainstream because he believed that. James Madison, father of the Constitution, maybe the best example. He spent a number of times in his life, he tried to calculate the population of the country and look at the westward expansion of the country and see how much land would be available that we would be able to keep economic equality in equipoise with what's necessary for a republic. And, he revised these estimates as the country moved westward. But toward the end of his life, in 1829, 1830, he actually said that it would be about 100 years, he thought, before the proportion being without property would be so high that we would have to do something about it. And what he said is, at that time, we would have to change the institutions and laws of the country. And this task would require the wisdom of the wisest patriots. That's what he said at the time. And so he understood that there were assumptions that he had built the Constitution on about the economic conditions, and that those would have to change, and future generations, these wise patriots of the future, would have to figure out how to make those changes and adapt to new conditions as they emerged.
And he nailed it. I mean, he was 100 years
1930,
out.
1930, it's almost the New Deal, right?
Before we head to 1930 and prior to that, the Progressive Era, I just want to talk a little bit about James Harrington, because you write that many of these concepts that were embedded in the creation of our Constitution were a function of what James Harrington was writing. Who is he, and what was he writing at the time?
So James Harrington is a 17th century English political philosopher writing in the mid-1600s, and what he argued is that the balance of power in politics would always mirror the balance of property, we could call that wealth, in society. And he thought that if the balance of property or wealth shifted, politics would eventually have to move as the people with property tried to gain more political power to align with the amount of property that they had. So if you had a very small number of people with property, they would try to influence politics, they would gain more power, and you'd end up with some sort of aristocracy. It might take a little while, but that's where you were headed. In contrast, if property was widely distributed, ordinary property owners would wonder why they don't have a share in government. They would create a revolution, and you would end up with what he called a commonwealth or a republic. And he saw this happen in England in the 1500s and 1600s, and that's how he kind of came up with this theory, is observing what was happening around him leading to the English Civil Wars in the 1600s and then the creation of the Commonwealth in England. And his story was well known to the founders. It was discussed by lots of the founders. And they actually all say, and this is where they get this idea, that there's this deep connection between economic equality and political equality. And it's from Harrington, it sticks in Harrington, and it's spread throughout much of English political theory after that. I think what's surprising is most people today have never heard of him. We think about the founding, we think of John Locke and his influence on Jefferson. There's some people who are real critics who think about Karl Marx and say everything was just a battle of wealthy people trying to rig the Constitution to serve their own interests. But Harrington's story is one that I think while it's been well known to scholars, has really not become part of our national discourse and consciousness.
Was there ever a time that it was, Harrington? Or no. is it one of those things where it just somehow that didn't stick through the years? Or was there a time where scholars' work on him fell out of disfavor?
So it Harrington's views have been known and understood in different ways throughout our history. So if you look at most of the 19th century and even into the early 20th century, echoes of Harrington, sometimes without citation, but echoes of Harrington appear all over the place in speeches, in political conversations and discourse. People talk a lot about this idea of the balance of power in politics linking to the balance of wealth in society. And so that's a common theme that comes up a lot. And so I think Harrington is really part of the story. In a sense, that drops off a little bit after World War II. And I think that happens in part because we are a country then that is booming economically. We have massive growth in the middle class. GDP is up. Median wages are up for workers. And so economic inequality is just less of an issue. And so we don't really pay as much attention to how it relates to having a republic. It's also a period in which we don't have much constitutional debate about economic policy because the New Dealers win a lot of those fights in the 1930s. And it's also a period where we move to being more afraid of communism during the Cold War, rather than being afraid of aristocracy and monarchies, which was something that people in our country were much more worried about in, say, the 150 years before that. So I think we lost some of that. And oddly, in that same period, in the kind of post-World War II era, is when scholars start picking up Harrington and doing more with him in the 50s, 60s, and 70s. And so Harrington becomes better known in the academy in that age, but sort of leaves the political realm.
Hmm. And all right, so I want to go back to prior to World War II and post World War II, to the and just a little bit before, I guess, Madison had anticipated needing to make some major reforms to our government to deal with, I guess what is essentially sort of a resource crunch in a way, right? I mean, when you're calculating how much space there is for the country and how much land is consumed or property is consumed by a growing population. I mean, that's what we're talking about. And that led, that first round, I guess, was the Progressive Era reforms. Just briefly let us, what happened during that era?
Yeah, so everything changes in the late 19th century. Industrialization, urbanization, the closing of the frontier, the shift from agriculture and artisanal work to wage labor in factories, these are big changes in the economy, and they put real pressure on the economic foundations and assumptions of our constitutional system. People at the time in the late 19th century recognized this, and the populists and then later the progressives try to take action, and they take action because they realize that these economic changes have resulted in economic inequality, the concentration of economic power, that power is bleeding into political power, and it's perverting our constitutional system from a republic into some sort of plutocracy or oligarchy. And they're very worried about this. And so what they do is they actually invent a number of extremely creative solutions to try to grapple with the challenges of industrialization. So on the economic side, the populists invent antitrust laws to break up concentrations of economic power. They also pass a constitutional amendment in the Progressive Era to have an income tax so people with a greater ability to pay can pay more. To prevent economic power from bleeding into political power, they pass the first campaign finance regulations in this time period. And they also pass another constitutional amendment to have the direct election of senators by the people instead of selection by the state legislatures, where there's a lot of bribery and other shenanigans going on to pick senators. So they understand that they need to create more of an economic democracy and more of a political democracy, and that these two things are linked. And that's really the fight in the populist and progressive eras.
I mean, how did that happen from a political standpoint? I mean, I know that the income tax was in many ways a function of prohibition, because that the progressives joined with the teetotalers and the sort of basically, I guess, the Christian conservatives, and there was a big push from women as well, that because at that time, all our taxes, I don't know if people realize this, from a federal level, was a function of alcohol, and at least the vast majority of it. And so the idea being that if you get rid of alcohol, you're going to need another source of taxes. And so this was, in my understanding anyways, is that that was a big impetus for the progressives to sign on to prohibition, because it would sort of force the introduction of an income tax. What is that? Is my understanding correct? A and B. How else was there so much reform that happened here that was directly aimed at the most powerful, I guess, players in our political economy at that time?
So, you know, for any one of these reforms, whether it's corporate taxes, the income tax, the direct election of senators, there's a lot of different stories and factors that feed into political change, just in the same way that today, when you think about how did Obamacare get passed or Dodd-Frank, there's just a lot of different stories we could tell and groups that came together to make that happen. In the case of the income tax, what I think is interesting is a slightly different story from the one you linked to prohibition, but is a story linked to the tariff. And for most of American history, from the founding through the 19th century, revenues to the federal government came from the tariff.
Okay.
And this was seen as okay, in part because high tariffs meant protection for infant industries at home, which meant jobs, and it meant that people were doing well at home. The problem, though, was that in the late 19th century, as you moved into an era of the trusts of monopoly power, there was no domestic there was shrinking domestic competition. And so what people were worried about is when you have this high tariff and you don't have domestic competition, you have monopolies that just raise prices. And so one of the shifts also that happens in this period is there's this massive pressure to oppose the tariff. And then that also creates energy to shift towards a progressive income tax instead as a revenue source for the government. So there's a number of things going on here, different kind of stories, and I think each are important. But this gets at this broader question of how did they do all this stuff? And I think the real answer here is there was a lot of popular energy across the country in lots of different places that was sustained for decades and decades, year after year, day after day. And that's what was really important about it. There were strike waves throughout the country. There were marches. There were organizing rallies. There were political action. And it happened in lots of different places, not just on one day, not just at one time. It was a really sustained effort over a period of time. And you know, a lot of these changes took a long time to get through. So in the 1880s, 1890s, the populists come up with a pretty amazing reform plan for the future. That, you know, is totally recognizable to us, even though it was, you know, almost 150 years ago. They advocated for the 8-hour workday. They advocated for minimum wage laws. They advocated for equal pay for equal work for women. In fact, they actually use exactly that phrase, equal pay for equal work, in the 1892 populist platform. And these kinds of things took decades in some cases to get through. And to make progress toward. And so part of the way they did this was a sustained campaign to try to make these changes over a period of time. And I think that's one of the important lessons that we can take from this historical understanding that I describe in the book, is that we actually have to be really committed at the popular level to putting pressure on political leaders, because that's how we get action and change.
And you list, or I should say, cover a bunch of possible fixes for not the least of which include antitrust laws. And I know that was going to be there was, you know, I guess in anticipation of a Clinton win, it seems to me that antitrust was going to be a prominent issue on the left to deal with income inequality.
So I think we're going to see antitrust as one of the more important issues of the next few years. You know, you're seeing a lot of people right now across the political spectrum and from a lot of different perspectives, lawyers, activists, economists, recognizing that we are living in a new age of massive consolidation in industry, and that this is a problem for having a competitive economy, an economy that works for entrepreneurs and small businesses, but also an economy that works for consumers and an economy that works for citizens and a country that works for citizens. Because when you have massive concentrations of economic power, it means that there are companies and trade associations that can spend millions and millions of dollars trying to lobby Congress in order to change the laws to serve their own interests and lock out all the little guys. And so I think antitrust is going to be one of the areas in the next couple in the next few years where you'll see, you know, more and more action. And if progressives take over, you know, one of the branches of government, I suspect you'll see even more action on antitrust issues as that happens.
I mean, would you rate and could you rate what you think would be in terms of priorities in dealing with the wealth inequality and then the sort of the subsequent political inequality? Is antitrust, I would imagine, is up there. Are there others that you see that are dollar for dollar, pound for pound, it gets you the most, I guess, return on your investment in terms of providing more wealth and political equality?
Well, I'm a more is more guy in terms of the kind of political action that we need to take. And so I would say there's a lot of different things that we can do, and we should be doing all of them and pushing pretty hard on all of them. And I know that's it's nice to say that from the academy, but I do think that's an important part of how we go forward. So some of the things that could be really impactful are things like minimum wages, increasing the minimum wage, really working to support unions and political movements that organize working class people, I think is a really important part of it. A lot of both our economic problems and our political problems are a function of not having real representation of the interests of ordinary people in the system and having over-representation of the interests of the wealthy and powerful entrenched corporate interests. And so rebalancing that, I think, is one of the more important things that we can do. There's a lot of things that we can also do that we talked about at the structural level. Antitrust is probably the most important in terms of a structural change to the economic system. But politically, we need to make some structural changes, particularly thinking about campaign finance and lobbying reforms to try to make it so that we have a much more level playing field between the different kinds of interests that are out there.
Can I ask you just one more question? I mean, this is a little bit it's a little bit more meta, but I mean, do you perceive yourself as a historian? And to the extent that you do, do you see any failures of historians in seeing the sort of a continuum here? I mean, because I mean, it's clearly it seems to me the story of crisis. Within, you know, in terms of our democracy, has been a function of the, accessibility of wealth, or how broadly it's shared, right? And whether that's a function of we don't really have a finite amount relative to the number of people we had, you know, in the early 1800s, or we are in a post-World War II boom where it seems like there is enough for everybody to go around in some way. Do you have a sense about the way that history is studied in this country that limits our imagination or our understanding of what's going on with questions around things like this?
So I don't consider myself a professional historian. I don't think any historian would consider me a professional historian. I'm a law professor. I teach constitutional law. I write about constitutional theory, constitutional law. And a big part of that, though, is learning, understanding, and understanding history. And I think one of the differences, though, between many historians and many constitutional lawyers is that many historians are really concerned about history for its own sake. And many constitutional lawyers are very interested in how the Constitution operates today, because there are real questions that we have to answer today about what it means to be in a constitutional democracy, what it means to have a republic, what it means to have equal protection of the laws or the freedom of speech. And these are live questions that exist for us. And so history isn't history for its own sake when you study constitutional law. History is the accumulated wisdom of the ages. It's analogy to that's experience that we can draw on from others. It's lessons. Sometimes we have to, and we have to be very cautious about what lessons we draw, but there are lessons potentially there. And so I think one of the important things for all of us to think about public policy today or about contemporary affairs is really trying to learn from history, because there's a lot of people who were very, very smart throughout our history who confronted very challenging situations, and we can learn a lot from them. We can learn a lot from what they did, what they didn't do. We can learn a lot by trying to put ourselves in their shoes and think about the difficult choices that they had to make and how they confronted them, what we might have done differently. And I think that's a really important part about what public service is about these days. And more history and more historical thinking, I think, among our elected officials would be a very good thing.
Ganesh Raman, the crisis of the middle class constitution, why economic inequality threatens our republic. Thank you so much for your time today. Really appreciate it.
Thanks so much. It's great being with you.